Would the clerk please call the next case?
The court will now call Dwayne Bracken versus the State of Texas. The man please the court, Mr. Gary Unison to argue for the appellate, Ms. Shelby White to argue for the state.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. As the clerk said, I'm Gary Unison. I represent Mr. Brackens in this case. Now, I appreciate the court setting this oral argument because even though it's a misdemeanor assault with a typical factual situation, kind of a he said, she said case, it has a very interesting legal issue, and I appreciate the opportunity to present oral argument on this. What we're really talking about, and just one initial comment before I really get into the facts, is that in a sense, the state should be more careful about what they ask for, because what they're really asking for, I think explicitly in the trial court and less explicitly here, is their argument basically is that when you have an offense that alleges knowingly and intentionally, here is knowingly intentionally caused bodily injury, it could be knowingly and intentionally causing death on a murder case, but essentially they're arguing is that recklessness is going to automatically be a lesser included offense. So here, reckless assault is an automatic lesser included offense. In a murder case, that would mean that involuntary manslaughter is automatic, because what they're really arguing is that because it technically can be a lesser included offense, that the analysis that's typically made, which is whether it's a rational alternative to the charged offense, or whether or not the jury, whether or not there's some evidence that by which a jury could say he's not guilty of the greater offense and is guilty of the lesser offense, they're really setting that aside, because the argument that they're making is essentially that if there's some evidence, if the jury believes some evidence that's presented that the person acted intentionally or knowingly, then that automatically means they could have acted recklessly. A couple of points that I think are important about this. First of all, we're talking about misdemeanor assault with bodily injury, and the definition of bodily injury as opposed to serious bodily injury, if this was a felony assault, aggravated assault, is important here, because the key words of the bodily injury definition are physical pain. So in order for there to be a lesser included offense possibility of recklessness in this case, or for the evidence to be sufficient for recklessness in this case, there has to be a showing that the defendant's actions didn't meet the definition of intentionally or knowingly, but meet the definition of recklessly. And so, of course, knowingly and intentionally means that he hits his objective or desire to cause the injury, or he knows his conduct is reasonably certain to cause the injury. But recklessness means he knows there's a substantial risk of the injury, but he consciously disregards it. So the key there is that, and I'll mention this one case that we cited in our brief, because I think it really addresses it directly, that the key there is that there has to be evidence that he did not intend or know that his actions could cause physical pain, but he knew there was a risk and disregarded it. And there's the Stepherson case that we cited in our brief, and the state may have cited it also, which from the Houston 14th Court of Appeals, where, and the section we quoted was where the Stepherson court said, the reckless person neither desires for the risk to occur, nor is he reasonably certain that it will occur, but he does perceive it. So here in this case, under that standard of the law, which I think is an accurate description of the law, Here, in order for the evidence to support recklessness, both from a sufficiency standpoint and from a standpoint of whether or not the state was entitled to the jury instructions, the evidence would have, it would have to be a reasonable construction of the evidence that he did not intend or know that his actions could cause physical pain. And
should we consider the fact that he was intoxicated, as maybe that was something the jury relied upon to find that he could have been reckless? Maybe he didn't know the force of the assault. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, Your Honor, the evidence was that he was not intoxicated, but she, the alleged victim, was intoxicated. The evidence was that Mr. Brackens and Ms. Hill and one other man had gone out to a club in Dallas and then come back to Fort Worth, and the other two people were intoxicated, but not Mr. Brackens because he was the driver. So the fact is, so I don't think there's anything in the record to say he was intoxicated.
Can you distinguish the Lampe case for me, the case the state relies upon out of Austin involving the ex-wife holding a doll?
Yeah. So in the Lampe case, the act there was that the defendant was accused of throwing or hitting his ex-wife with a doll that caused bodily injury, I guess physical pain of some kind. And so the question is, and as opposed to here, where the evidence, according to Ms. Hill, was that he hit her in the face, he knocked her down, the police observed significant injuries on her face, swollen lip, bruises, that sort of thing. So in the Lampe case, that particular conduct of throwing or hitting somebody with a doll may or may not constitute bodily injury. It's not something, that conduct is not something that invariably is going to cause bodily injury. Whereas hitting somebody, sort of viciously hitting somebody in the face, is something that invariably will cause bodily injury, but because it causes pain.
Can you foresee a situation, I'm just trying to think of something that might have gone through the jury's mind, I don't know what the evidence was on this, but if your client was, for example, swinging his fist, not intending to necessarily hit her, but she's drunk and falls toward him and he does hit her, would that be reckless assault?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, that's not the evidence in the case. If he's swinging his fist with the intention to hit her, then that's not going to be reckless.
Well, what if he's trying to get her out of his face or something?
If he was swinging his fist in front of her, like waving his fist around, trying to get her to back up, I suppose you could say that's reckless if she stumbles into him waving his fist or his arm around. But the facts here, there's really two diametrically opposed fact situations. Ms. Hill says that he hit her and knocked her to the ground, and then the police observed multiple injuries on her face, she had a scraped up leg. He says he never hit her or touched her at all, that she was hitting him in the car on the way home, and then when they got home, because she was drunk, she fell down, and that's how she got her injuries. Now, there was the witness, the third person that was with them, supported Mr. Bracken's version rather than Ms. Hill's version, which very well, and I know, of course, not going to speculate about why the jury did what they did, but the evidence that certainly would indicate a reason why the jury might not go with it intentionally or knowingly. But the fact is that the state asked for the reckless charge. The defendant objected to it. So it's a situation that usually the defendants are in this situation where you're hedging your bets by asking for a lesser included offense. Here the state's hedging their bets, asking for a lesser included offense that's not supported by the evidence, but it gives the jury the ability to do something they're not really supposed to do, which is just compromise on something that doesn't fit the facts of the case, which I think very well may be what happened here. Let me make a comment about the case that the state filed a supplemental letter brief yesterday citing a case that came out of this court in July, the Byers case. And the Byers case, the victim's story, her story in the Byers case, it's another kind of he said, she said case. Her story was the defendant put his hands around her throat with some pressure, and then he let her go, and that he then pinned her to the ground and banged her head against the hardwood floor 3 to 5 times. And then his story there was that he had pushed her to the floor and she hit her head, but essentially it was accidentally, because he said what he had really done was kind of taken her by the shoulders, was trying to escort her or push her out of the house, and then they tripped and they both fell to the floor and she hit her head. The police officer there, just like here, you have a police officer that responds to the incident and observes some injuries on the alleged victim. The injuries there were that he saw red marks on her neck, but no bruises on her head. So what that indicates, and that's the difference between, this is the difference between Byers and this case, that indicates that it was not the type of violent, sort of vicious assault we have here. So if, the opinion doesn't go into great detail about this, but for instance, if he put his hands around her neck, but not so hard that it caused a significant injury, I suppose you could say, because of the nature of the injury there, which was just some red marks and nothing, no bangs on the head or bruises on the head, I suppose you could say he did not intend or know he was going to cause bodily injury, but he was reckless by doing the acts he did. The other distinction there is that the defendant's own story there could justify a finding of recklessness, because he said he took her by her shoulders and is sort of moving her out of the house, and in the course of that they trip and fall, and that's how she gets her injuries. So I suppose you could say in that case that he's reckless because he perceives but disregards a risk that by physically trying to move her he could somehow injure her. But in this case, there's nothing like that, because in this case, Mr. Bracken's testimony and the story he told the police was that he did nothing. You know, he really did nothing to her. So you have no testimony from him that you could point to and say this would justify a recklessness finding. And her testimony, her story of what happened, doesn't justify recklessness finding, because it's a clearly intentional, vicious sort of attack on her that, according to what the police observed, if you believe her story, that's what caused the significant injury. So the case the state cited really doesn't support the argument. The problem is I can foresee a situation, this is why I say the state may want to be more careful about what they ask for. I think what they're really asking this court to do is significantly loosen the rules for when a lesser included offense charge is appropriate by saying basically if the lesser offense is a legally potential lesser offense, then it should be given in virtually or maybe every case, but certainly virtually every case. So if that applies to a misdemeanor assault case where the state is asking for the lesser included offense, it's going to apply in a murder case where the defendant's asking for a lesser included offense of involuntary manslaughter for recklessly causing the death. So either the law is, and I believe it's clear that this is what it is, either the law is, it is necessary that there be evidence in the record that clearly supports recklessness as a rational, valid alternative to the charged offense, or that or you don't really need that, and it's always going to be a lesser offense if you have reckless under knowingly and intentionally. And so I think what the state's argument is really for a step away from the law, or certainly an expansion of the law. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Shelby White, and I represent the state. Today, I intend to spend most of my time talking about the main kind of legal sufficiency issue that we're dealing with. I know there's also a jury submission issue, but I think both sides agree if there is legally sufficient evidence, it should be submitted to the jury and vice versa. So I won't go into that unless you'll have particular questions about it. So first, I wanted to discuss what the law is regarding reckless assault, and I think this is a point that we've disagreed with in the briefing. Assault is a result-oriented offense, which means that you don't look at the means by which the assault was committed. You can swing a fist, you can swing a bat, you can pull a trigger. What you're looking at is the result. Was there bodily injury? And so then when you look at determining intent, you look at the actor's intent as to the result. Did they intend to cause bodily injury when they did this? Or were they committing it knowingly? Or in this case, were they committing it recklessly? Which means you recognize the potential for the bodily injury and you just choose to disregard it or ignore it. The jury is obviously going to infer what the intent is from circumstantial evidence. You're very rarely going to have the defendant get up and testify, this is what I thought of when I was doing this. And so you're going to look at the words, the act, the conduct of the accused, and the conduct of the other parties involved. I think the appellant here is looking at the intent to commit the action that, you know, because you're swinging a fist, you must necessarily intend to cause bodily injury. And I think some of the examples we've seen here, that's not necessarily always true. There's certainly hundreds of YouTube videos of teen boys swinging fists at each other, and I don't think that you would say that all of those are with the intent to cause injury. They're looking to be YouTube stars, and to just kind of mess around.
But do those facts fit this circumstance?
Obviously, the YouTube star scenario does not, but I think that what we see here, this kind of gets to my second point, which was to look at the particular evidence in this case. Appellant has presented this sort of binary choice of either he swung a fist with the vicious intent to cause harm, or he never touched her at all. And we actually have six different testimonies about what actually occurred. We first have Ms. Hill's contemporaneous statements to Officer Winter directly after the assault. We have Mr. Bracken's contemporaneous statements to Officer Winter. We have Officer Winter's testimony at trial, which is his interpretation of what he thought happened. Then we have the 911 phone call. And then we have Mrs. Hill's testimony at trial, and then we have Mr. Tippin, the third party in the backseat, his testimony at trial. And so obviously the jury is allowed to believe any, all, some, none of those pieces of testimony and to reconcile any conflicts in those. And so if we look at first what Ms. Hill says to Officer Winter, at that time she says she admits that there was a verbal altercation in the car, but she denies any physical altercation. And then she says, when I got out of the car, he hit me first in the back of the head, and that I turned around and swung a punch at him, and that's when he hit me the second time, and that when he hit me that second time, I fell down. Then Mr. Brackens obviously says to Officer Winter, I never touched her, I just got out of the car and walked towards the front door, and I kind of hear this thud in the background, and I realize that she fell down. Then we have Officer Winter's testimony. He says she looked visibly upset from being punched in the face, which is that it looked like a punch to the face, not a fall, and that the way she was acting, the fact that she was so upset was inconsistent with this idea of her just drunkenly falling down. And then we have the 911 phone call where the neighbor says, quote, I just hear them out there fighting and arguing and cussing and screaming, which is consistent with this idea of there was more of a blow up and a dramatic fight going on between the two of them. And then at trial, Ms. Hill testifies. She says, I had a concussion. I don't really remember anything up until the point that he hit me in the face. What would be the second time. And that's kind of the only memory she has. She said, he viciously struck me in the face and I fell down. And then you have Mr. Tippin's testimony, which was that Ms. Hill was drunk and that she just fell getting out of the car and then, you know, was too drunk to even stand up. But all of this goes to, when you reconcile these different pieces of evidence, there is legally sufficient evidence for the jury to arrive at this conclusion of recklessness because, you know, the fact that you're swinging a fist, you may be intending to swing the fist, and recklessness still recognizes the potential for harm. They're not, intentional and reckless are not so diametrically opposed on the spectrum as appellant is proposing. Intentional is, I knew that there was going to be harm and I meant to cause that harm. And then reckless kind of on the other end is, I saw this potential for harm and I just ignored it. I did it anyways. And I didn't care that there was going to be harm necessarily. But it doesn't have that specific, I want you to be harmed. And so when you have a situation here where they're screaming and fighting and they have such a background of a contentious relationship where they've been fighting in the car beforehand, where there's kind of the story of he's dating her and having an affair with her, but he also has another girlfriend who lives in New York, and she's upset that the other girlfriend has called while they're at the club, that they have a child together, and there's a bit of a custody dispute. She testifies at trial that after he punched her and she fell down, that he leaned over and called her a prostitute and a gold digger. So this is evidence of something that's much more contentious than this presentation that appellant has given, which is just, he calmly got out of the car, walked around, and socked me in the face. There's a lot more to this, and there's a lot more for the jury to determine that he was upset and he was mad, and maybe he just wanted her to be quiet, maybe he wanted her to get away from him, but that he could have just disregarded the risk that she was going to be injured by him swinging the fist.
Was there some sort of tactical reason why a state would wait until the case is about to be submitted to the jury to ask for a lesser included?
I'm not sure that, and I obviously can't testify as to what the prosecutors in this case, what their tactic was, but I don't think there's really necessarily a benefit to doing it that way, because you still have to present the same, you still have to present evidence as to recklessness. And so either way, if you do it at the beginning or you do it at the end, there's got to be some evidence for the judge to determine that it's an appropriate charge for the court and for the jury to be able to have legally sufficient evidence to make that finding.
What evidence is in the record that he didn't care whether she was harmed or not?
And so that's, when you're talking about intent, you're obviously inferring by words and by conduct and by action, and not necessarily testimony of, I didn't care or I didn't think about whether or not she'd be harmed. Obviously, we don't have him saying that. But
what evidence is there without his testimony?
So when you look at recklessness, a lot of times it is the sort of scenario where we have here, where it's two people that are fighting and screaming and yelling, and they're not, it's not this sort of calm, thought out, intentional motive behind the actions. It's more of a, I want you to get away, I want this fight to be over, I'm just mad and I'm upset at you, but not, I think you can't say definitively that there's only evidence that he intentionally hit her, which is what the appellant is trying to present here. So I think the jury, certainly there's enough for the jury to have determined that he didn't have the kind of prerequisite intent to harm behind his actions. But he could have seen the risk for harm, known that swinging a fist might cause some harm, and said, I just don't care. I just want you to get away from me. I just want this fight to be over. I just want you to shut up, however it goes. So I think ultimately what we're looking at is the appellant is asking us to pull the issue of intent out of the jury's hands. And this is something that, you know, the standard is pretty high for the court to do that in that sort of case. And so we would ask that the court hold that there is, in fact, legally sufficient evidence for a finding of reckless assault, and therefore that issue was properly submitted to the jury, and that the court would affirm the appellant's conviction for reckless assault. If there are no more questions, then I will go ahead and yield the rest of my time to the court.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I really just have one comment, and this is based upon what something the state said towards the end. I think maybe they're saying that the evidence supporting recklessness is some kind of an argument that he did not really intend to hit her. You know, that he was doing something that caused himself to hit her, but he wasn't trying to hit her. And that's just simply not in the record. He didn't say that. She didn't say that. There's just nothing in the record to support that. And so, and that's almost sort of like in a murder case, the defendant doesn't testify, then he asked for a lesser included offense of involuntary manslaughter based upon recklessness. And he says, you know, there's evidence he didn't intend to kill the person because it doesn't have to be anything in the record. Maybe just the jury could think that. But that's not how you determine lesser-included offenses, and that's not how you determine the sufficiency of the evidence. So I just don't think it's there from the state's argument or anything in the record. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your argument. It's been helpful. We appreciate you taking your time to do this. Your case has now been submitted, and you're free to go about your business.